Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento is breaking ground on a new solution to homelessness, caring for the terminally ill who are unhoused to ensure their final moments include dignity and respect. The facility is called Joshua's House, which will become the first hospice for those experiencing homelessness in the West Coast. The founder is Marlene Von Friedrich Fitzwater, who's been working to make Joshua's House a reality in Sacramento for the past several years, an endeavor sparked by a compassionate connection to homelessness. Well, good morning, Marlene. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for asking me to join you.
We met about 4 years ago, back in 2018, talking about Joshua's House. We're now here 4 years later. There is a groundbreaking to celebrate. Take us back to 2018 or even before then, the origin story about Joshua's House.
I'm happy to do that. It actually all started back in the kind of mid-20s, about 2013 maybe. I had reconnected with a grandson who I loved very much and cared about. We've been in connection, in contact off and on through his life. I was in the delivery room when he was born. And so we were very close. And his name was Joshua. And unfortunately, he became addicted to drugs shortly after graduating from high school. And so he spent a lot of his young adult life being homeless. But he was so talented. He was a wonderful musician. He wrote and performed music. He was loving and caring and very compassionate. And he would share stories with me about the other homeless people he met. And it became apparent to him that a lot of them were terminally ill, had cancer, heart disease, whatever, and were dying on the street in the various cities where he would be. And so I was then a professor at the UCD School of Medicine and also directed the Cancer Center's outreach and education program. And so I started kind of talking to homeless people here in this community. Actually ended up doing about 170 interviews with homeless men and women of all ages, from about 18 to probably mid-60s. And the common fear among all of them, when we would talk about their health concerns or health issues, their common fear was dying on the street, because they had seen that that's what happens to people who are terminally ill. And so Josh and I started talking about what we could do, what would work, how we could do it. And so I started thinking about it and planning it, but then nothing really happened. And he died on the streets in Omaha, Nebraska of an overdose in 2014. And then I became really committed to this. And so I continued to work at UCD while I was doing research and trying to learn as much as I could about, were there other programs that did that in the United States that took care of terminally ill homeless people, and discovered there weren't that many. There was a fairly new one that was just starting in Salt Lake City. So I actually went there, interviewed the executive director, learned a lot about what they did. And I learned that one of their big mistakes was that they planned it all and were ready to open and then took it to their city council. And the city council shut it down. And it took them another 2 years to be able to open. So when I retired in January of 2016, I knew my first steps were to get the city council, the mayor, as many of the leaders in our community involved from the very beginning. And I was really fortunate. One of the first people I met and talked to was Sister Libby Fernandez. And she was then the CEO of Loaves and Fishes, which is our local community program that feeds and helps homeless people. And so she immediately set up an appointment to introduce me to Daryl Steinberg, who would be coming in as the mayor of Sacramento. She also set up a meeting to meet Jeff Harris, who was a city council member over that district, that area. And And then Jeff Harris, both of Daryl and Jeff Harris became very, very supportive. And Jeff linked us to the Thomas Law Group, Tina Thomas and Nick Abdus. And they just, I mean, they've given us probably thousands of hours of volunteer legal work. And Tina has made large personal donations. They've just been our guardians. I mean, they've made the right introductions. They got the right support. They helped us move forward. So the first building I fell in love with was a building on North C Street, very close to Loaves and Fishes.
And that's where we first met.
Yes, yes. We actually toured that and talked about it. I loved that building, but it was almost a 100-year-old building. And it was in a historic site. So by the time the city figured out, so we bought the building. And by the time the city figured out what we would have to do to retrofit it and maintain the historic principles of it, the historic things about it, it would have been over $5 million. And I knew there was no way we could raise that kind of money in a short period of time. So finally made the decision to put it on the market and sell it. And that was right about, I think, just before maybe the pandemic happened. But fortunately, we sold it in 2 weeks. And so we didn't lose a huge amount of money. And we were able then to begin to look at other property. And then that began a journey of property that we thought would work. And then the property owner would decide he or she didn't really want to sell it to us. And it was a long struggle. We had people who stepped up and wanted to kind of support Joshua's house and help us get it built and get it open and then backed out. And so it's been a really long, hard journey and struggle.
Yeah, I remember back in 2018 when we were talking about Joshua's house, you know, the groundbreaking was not supposed to be in 2022, 4 years later. And for context, that historic building, it was really good in terms of proximity because it was close to Loaves and Fishes. So where is the new location now?
So the new location now is in just off of Northgate and Large Wood Drive. So it's in what's called South Natomas. It's a beautiful piece of property in a really nice area. There are not close by, but there are homes and there are businesses around it. But it's a beautiful, it's almost a little over five acre piece of property that the city owns. And it's been empty and vacant for years and years and years while the city's been trying to determine how they would use it. And Jeff Harris was really responsible to, it took him about a year, a little over a year to have the city agree to lease a little over an acre of that property to us for Joshua's house. And so we just signed the lease a couple months ago. It's for 50 years and no rent, but we will pay annual property tax.
This will become the first hospice for those unhoused and terminally ill in the West Coast. Help us visualize what Joshua's house will look like.
I am happy to do that. And I'm happy to say, I think, you know, over those years of trying to figure out where we would be and how we would be set up, I think we came up with the ideal solution. So we've ordered and paid for 6 ADA compliant mobile homes. They're manufactured homes, actually. They don't look like a mobile home. They're manufactured homes. And those are in production now. And then each one will have 3 bedrooms. So we'll use 5 of those houses to house terminally ill homeless folks. And we'll use 1 of those houses for office and meeting space and storage space. So we'll be able to start by serving 15 terminally ill homeless men and women. And I don't know if you remember that they will come into Joshua's house through a referral from one of the 4 health systems.
Right.
So Dignity, Sutter, Kaiser, and UC Davis. And then they will provide hospice care and will provide comfort and supportive care, shelter, clothing, meals, We've even have some folks who want to do art therapy and music therapy for those residents who want that. So we'll provide everything, all the other services, and the local health systems will provide hospice service. Mm.
You, in this time, when working for this ground, towards this groundbreaking, have continued to help people. And back in 2018, when we met, I also met Jamie Murphy, and we followed him in his final months. He had terminal cancer until he passed away. He's one of the people that I've met in my career that just stay in my heart. He was a wonderful person. Can you tell us about Jamie? Because you introduced Jamie to me.
Jamie was a remarkable person. And I keep thinking, I think Josh has had a hand in some of this, because the way I've met people has been so kind of strange. But Jamie called kind of out of the blue and said someone had given him my phone number and that I had a hospice house for the terminally ill homeless, and that he was homeless and had advanced cancer and was terminally ill. And I had to explain to him, well, Joshua's house doesn't exist yet, but how can I help you? And that was about, I met him and had the first conversation with him about 2 weeks before the idea of Joshua's house was going to be presented at the city council weekly meeting. And so Jamie and I got to know each other a little bit, and he wanted to appear before the city council and say how needed this would be and how necessary it was. And so he did. And I think he moved the city council's hearts too, because they really appreciated hearing from him. And then I'm happy that we were able to get him into, for a while, a motel room where he had shelter, and we provided food and clothing. Got him what he needed to survive, took him around to things where he had to go. And we were able to get a hospice team involved to kind of help take care of him. And then toward the end, as he got sicker and less mobile, we were able to get him into a really nice mobile home. And he had someone with him almost constantly. We were able to get some of our volunteers to be with him and help him. And I'm happy to know he didn't die alone. He didn't die on the street. And Jamie was just, as he got closer to dying, he just said how important it was to always keep him connected and to let people know how much this helped him and how much he appreciated it. He was just a very sweet, very loving man.
Yeah, the last time I saw him was in that mobile home, and it was just about a week or two before he passed away. And one of the last things he said was he wanted to ensure that other people in his situation would have the opportunity to pass away with dignity, respect, and comfort. And now this is coming to fruition with this groundbreaking. What does the road ahead look like?
Well, the next steps are we're working on an agreement with HomeAid, which is a nonprofit, actually national association of builders and contractors and folks like that. And they do work either really, really inexpensively or sometimes free for other nonprofits around building issues. And so we're working on an agreement with HomeAid where they would build the foundations for the manufactured homes. They would do the paving necessary, so we have parking and a way in and out of the property. And they would do the landscaping, and the property will be completely fenced and beautifully landscaped. You know, we've had obviously concern from some neighbors in that area who really don't want us there. And I've tried to assure them how hard we're going to work at being a good neighbor and keeping the property safe and secure for the residents, but also for the neighbors. And these folks, when they get discharged into Joshua's house, they're not highly mobile, most of them, unfortunately.
They're in hospice.
Yeah. And they don't, you know, you or I could go into hospice and be pretty active. And my mother was in and out of hospice twice before she died. But these folks don't get diagnosed and treated until they're pretty far along in their disease. So generally, they only have 2 or 3 months to live. And so they're not going to be highly mobile, but we've created in the space on the property, we've created garden areas where they can go outside and sit, and places where they can have their, if they have a dog, for example, and they go into Joshua's house, we have a wonderful nonprofit that will take that dog and train it and housebreak it and make sure it goes into a loving home. But they also can bring that dog back to visit if that's desired. And so the residents will have a very private and beautiful, quiet place to be. And it's not going to have the negative effect on the community that I think some people think it will.
Yeah. Finally, Marlene, I mean, when it comes to the crisis of homelessness, it has just continued to grow and grow in recent years. What do you want people to understand that you think is missing from the conversation about those experiencing homelessness?
Well, I think I'd want them to understand those. I'll probably start crying now, but those are the sons and daughters and sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and moms and dads of any one of us. And yes, there are issues. People become homeless because they are mentally ill and we don't have enough mental services available, mental health services available to people. They become homeless because they're addicted to drugs and alcohol. But there aren't enough programs to help people get out of that addiction. And some are homeless. They just get out of prison or jail and they have nowhere to go. And once you become homeless, it's really hard to get out of that. You don't have clean clothes. You don't have a place to shower and be clean yourself. And there things get stolen. We helped a homeless man who had his social security, driver's, everything stolen multiple times. And so without that, they can't go apply for a job. They don't have a permanent residence, so they don't have an address, and they'll use loaves and fishes maybe for their address. But people don't choose to be homeless. It's not a choice that they make. And it is increasing. It's increasing dramatically. Because the housing costs in our community and throughout most of the United States have gotten so high that working people can't afford rent or to buy a house. There are a number of young couples, both working with toddlers, living in their cars. A number of Sac State students are homeless. And I mean, this is becoming such a huge population that I think we all better get busy and start finding solutions. And I hope, I've had people from all over the United States come visit me about Joshua's house. And I just hope that type of program for the terminally ill homeless will happen all over the place. I hope there'll be several in every community. We need more than ours here. We're going to eventually, we hope to add a couple more homes on our property. So we hope to get up to being able to serve 24 people. But that's not enough. So I hope this inspires people to do something similar or see how they can help and what can be done.
Thank you so much, Marlene.
Thank you, Vicki, very much.
And that is my conversation with Marlene von Friedrich Fitzwater, the founder of Joshua's House Hospice in Sacramento, which will become the first hospice care for the terminally ill experiencing homelessness in the West Coast. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The monkeypox outbreak is reminding us of harmful lessons we've learned from past public health crises. When public awareness is communicated in a negligent or harmful way, stigma can easily follow. We've learned the consequences during the HIV/AIDS crisis targeting the gay community, and more recently, how the onset of the COVID pandemic in 2020 impacted Asian communities. The CDC reports worldwide there are more than 1,800 monkeypox cases spanning 35 countries. In the United States, there are currently a total of 65 cases, 15 of which in California. While monkeypox can be spread to anyone via close skin-to-skin contact and is not considered a sexually transmitted infection, both the World Health Organization and CDC are focusing a heightened awareness on gay and bisexual men, which opens a historically vulnerable group to becoming stigmatized once again and during Pride Month nonetheless. We're going to spend some time learning how LGBTQ+ advocates are providing outreach to the community and their advice on how we should talk about monkeypox while reducing harm. David Heistuman is CEO at the Sacramento LGBT Center, joined by Alexis Sanchez, Director of Advocacy and Training. Good morning. Welcome both of you to Insight.
Good morning, Vic.
Well, Good morning. Yeah. Well, I want to start with the two of you leading the way. You know, your center is just coming off the energy of the Sacramento Pride March and Festival. I went on Sunday and it was so much fun. What conversations are you having about monkeypox in terms of raising awareness, but also perhaps more critical conversations about how this outbreak is being communicated? David, I'll start with you.
Sure. I mean, so for us, we're sort of coordinating and thinking about and communicating with other LGBT organizations across the country who are sort of seeing what's happening in their communities. And really, a lot of people are hearkening back to the beginning of the HIV epidemic when public health wasn't paying super close attention. People didn't think that they could get it. And so right now we're really focused on just doing some general education with community members about what to look for and what the symptoms are and how it spreads, and to make sure that if they are experiencing any of these symptoms or they suspect that they might have been in contact with someone, that they contact their healthcare provider, that they call them and really be a self-advocate for what might be going on.
Alexis, your focus is advocacy and training. What stands out to you about how monkeypox is being communicated?
I think it really is balancing community awareness with not perpetuating any negative stereotypes about the community, and also communicating accurate information of how monkeypox is transmitted and how it is prevented. The thing that I've been talking about with many of our community members is that the interventions that work to prevent HIV and the spread of COVID are going to go a long way towards preventing monkeypox, right? There is a higher prevalence of COVID-19, especially in our community right now, and there is still a high prevalence of HIV in certain communities in Sacramento. So if we are doing things such as getting tested regularly, if we're doing things such as using barriers and other forms of protection, that's going to go a long way towards preventing monkeypox. I think there is space for nuance, right? Like with monkeypox, we have to talk about fomite transmission and sweat and other things like that. But generally, broad strokes, we're really leaning into a general prevention message across all three diseases.
Yeah, Alexis, you're pulling on a lot of threads that I want to unpack. I mean, first, given that this virus spreads via close contact, I mean, it can involve sexual contact, but also it could involve sports, dancing, hugging, shared clothing, you know, just close skin-to-skin contact. Does potentially labeling a group, can that be misguided and harmful in the long run? And if so, does that concern you, Alexis?
Absolutely. So something that we saw in the early stages of the HIV/AIDS epidemic was the disease was labeled as a quote-unquote gay disease, right? So we had bisexual men who were transmitting. We had cisgender heterosexual couples that were contracting HIV and not understanding that they could still spread it to other individuals. So really talking about how the disease spreads from skin to skin contact, from sweat, and saying that it could affect really anyone is really, really, really important. Mm.
David, what Alexis brought up is, you know, following the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 1980s and the decades since, did public awareness grow? And do you think that may be a factor as to why a large number of cases have been tied to men who have sex with men? The fact that they're being proactive and regularly getting tested is a norm and feeling comfortable with relying on health providers and that it's generally accepted.
I think that is part of it, but I also think that some people are still not comfortable having those conversations with their medical providers, and particularly because it is a rare disease, the monkeypox disease is a rare disease, your primary care provider might not be thinking about it as a possibility. And so that's why I mentioned being a self-advocate for yourself and really understanding that it could be something that you have contracted if you've been in very close contact with someone. And being comfortable having those conversations with your provider so that they can check for it, so they can do the test so that you could become vaccinated if you were in close contact with someone, and take the steps that are necessary to prevent the spread more widely in the community.
Are you concerned that this opens up the gay community to being discriminated once again?
I want to be hopeful that that's not going to be the case. And at the same time, I think it's really important that there be a strong partnership between public health and community-based organizations that are really looking to ensure that we respond very quickly to these kinds of outbreaks. Right now, most of the cases have been folks who have been connected to people who are connected to an LGBT-focused event. In Europe, but that very quickly can change. To Alexis's point, this isn't a disease that discriminates, and so it can affect any person, and very likely will if we don't get under control right away.
Yeah, Alexis, you also brought up the reality that we're still in a pandemic. Sacramento is still considered high risk when it comes to COVID-19, according to the CDC. Has navigating the pandemic shaped the way you're approaching monkeypox?
I think we have to take into account a level of pandemic fatigue, right? When speaking with community members, it could be that we start to talk about the dangers of another dangerous virus, and we just see folks kind of glaze over. Like, I've been on high alert for 2.5 years, and here's one more thing that I have to worry about. But it really is driving home, right, that this is, we want to keep this controlled, right? We don't want monkeypox to become endemic. And part of controlling the spread of monkeypox is also going to go, you know, a long way towards controlling the spread of COVID-19 and HIV. So I try and talk about the three of them kind of interconnected.
Yeah, I think all of us are in a fatigue of being in a pandemic, endemic with subvariants and now another outbreak of a different virus. You know, Alexis, timeliness of all of this is happening during Pride Month. It's also a time when LGBTQ rights are being challenged across the country, especially harming trans women of color. Given that you also have a heightened focus on advocating for the trans community, what conversations are you having?
Not enough conversation is generally what I would say, right? I think as an advocate can only do so much, but it really comes down to everyone really educating themselves and not perpetuating stigma towards particular groups and particular individuals. When I talk about and do advocacy for transgender women and transgender women of color, I talk about, my own background is in public health, and I like to talk about the social determinants of health and why, marginalized communities tend to have higher risk for certain illnesses. And it's not because they have certain behaviors, but it's more about built environment and less access to primary care, less access to all sorts of resources, which are going to keep a person healthy, right? So when I'm talking about prevention, not perpetuating stigma in communities, I'm also talking about what puts certain communities at higher risk as well, and what we can do to sort of address some of those things.
Yeah. It's also important to mention that when it comes to monkeypox, it's not life-threatening like HIV or AIDS in the 80s and in 1990s or even COVID-19. Most cases clear up on their own within a few weeks, but the recommendation is to quarantine and isolate. Yeah, David, given that you're the CEO of the Sacramento LGBT Center, what is the best way to communicate this? And have there been some conversations or even public health alerts that have made you cringe a little bit?
You're right. It is not 1983. This is a treatable disease. There is a vaccine available for it, and there are great ways to prevent it. So it's important to remember that this isn't AIDS and that it's not as deadly as COVID-19 can be either. And we have really effective tools. So have I seen really messages that I think are not helpful or are particularly stigmatizing? I'm not sure that I have so far, but I would emphasize that public health and community-based organizations really need to try and avoid targeting particular populations, that just the gay community or just the bisexual community, in their outreach, because this is a virus that can spread to anyone. And I really would like to be able to avoid a situation where we start targeting and only talking to LGBT people, because that's where the cases have been in the beginning, because that is not where things will be from a public health perspective if we don't educate everyone in the community.
Yeah, I was just reading that earlier this month, the White House held a call with advocates and nonprofits to discuss messaging and outreach. David, what does that signal? And is that progress?
You know, I think it is progress to the degree that in the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, the White House and public health officials at the federal level were not paying attention and were really dismissing the whole notion of this being something that could widely affect the population at large. And so it's positive. It's a positive sign that the people are paying attention, that local public health is paying attention, that they're taking it seriously. They're getting folks tested who are in close contact and contact tracing. Vaccines were made available to local public health right away. And so all those things are positive signs that we did not see at the beginning of the HIV crisis. Hmm.
Alexis, do you see that as progress as well? Or are there obviously some more gaps to fill and hurdles to overcome?
Yeah, I always see visibility as sort of a double-edged sword, right? I think more awareness is really, really great. And I think the fact that, as David was mentioning, in contrasting to the federal response to HIV/AIDS in the early days, the fact that the government is even talking about this is really, really promising. But then again, it's the things that we've mentioned throughout this call. We have to be really careful with messaging because we don't want an increased spotlight to perpetuate stigma against certain groups.
Yeah. Finally, I want to end on a positive note because I had the Sacramento LGBT Center on last week previewing Pride March and Festival. I just want to ask both of you how the weekend went. David?
You know, it was really an amazing weekend. It's our first time back since 2019. It really was an opportunity for a community to gather for the first time in a really significant, large way. Saturday was really hot out there, but Sunday was a perfect day. The march was wonderful. The festival was beautiful. And you know, we got very close to my perfect 86 degree Pride weather. So it was a really fun event. Really did give people the opportunity to be themselves, express themselves, and be together with community after such a long period of isolation.
Yeah. Alexis, I would imagine it took on, you know, a newer, deeper meaning for you. Were there some moments over the weekend that kind of stick with you more?
I think for me, it was just seeing the crowd having a really great time. A lot of our program is focused, a lot of our programming at the Sacramento LGBT Center is focused on young adults, right? Folks who are 18 to 25. And I saw so many people in those demographics that were just having a really great time. And I know from my public health experience, like that demographic can be prone to depression, anxiety, and all sorts of other negative mental and physical health poor outcomes if they don't have access to community, right? So seeing a bunch of young folks in community for me was really, really great. It means that we're doing really great work at the Sacramento LGBT Center and with our kind of partner organizations to create a community that sees young adults and holds them and kind of like helps them grow into like really, really wonderful folks.
Well, I want to thank the both of you for having a conversation that's so important, but it can be kind of challenging because there's a lot of nuances and layers to it. Thank you so much, Alexis and David.
Thanks.
And that is David Heistumann, CEO at the Sacramento LGBT Center, joined by Alexis Sanchez, Director of Advocacy and Training, also at the Sacramento LGBT Center. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, if you have a love for the 80s and want to relive a classic decade in music, you don't need a flashy DeLorean souped up with 1.21 gigawatts of electricity. The Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus is dusting off their shoulder pads, big hair, and bold colors for their spring concert, SGMC to the max. The performances at the Sophia in Midtown Sacramento promise to be packed with power ballads and pop hits. For the chorus, the performance is more than a trip down memory lane. It's also a celebration of the decade when the chorus was founded 38 years ago in Sacramento, when they became a refuge for gay men seeking support and a sense of community. In the decade since, the chorus has become an intrinsic part of the community and a voice for LGBTQ plus rights and inclusion. Joining us now to tell us more about this performance and how the chorus tries to enhance lives and build pride one song at a time is Christian Bohm, Artistic Director of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus. Christian, good morning. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Happy to have you. I grew up with the 80s. My parents love 80s music, and it's chock full of incredible hits from power ballads to pop classics. My mom says it's the best decade ever. What songs will the chorus be performing, and how did you select the songs that you did?
Well, first of all, I'm in total agreement with your mom. I came up through the 80s. I graduated high school. I went to college. So, you know, some of those life-changing experiences all enhanced by 80s music. So when we go back to the 80s, for me, it's reliving some of the most wonderful moments of my life. We will have hits from the Pointer Sisters, Madonna, Dolly Parton, Bon Jovi, even. It's going to be an amazing tour de force. Yeah. You ask how I pick the music. Well, there's so much great 80s music, right? It's just, how did I do it? Well, I went through and picked out 50 of my favorites, started there. But then I had to consider, we're going to have 100 voices singing this music, right? So which of these songs will translate well to a big chorus? So that was my first priority, and I picked songs. There's a couple of power ballads, as you mentioned, that are just powerful with 100 strong voices singing. The audience, I think, will be really moved, because when I hear it, I moved. So that was my selection criterion.
Yeah, I can imagine. You're adding a whole different effect and feeling to it by having a chorus behind 80s music. And it is, I mean, I would imagine you going through all of your favorite songs. It was probably it was fun, but probably like exhausting and overstimulating as well, because there's so much to choose from in the 80s.
Right. And for a couple of months before I started actually picking, I just sat on 80s playlists, you know, I just reliving what songs that I loved and landing, and every so often be like, oh yeah, that is the song. This is the song. So it was a really fun process for me.
Given that the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus has been around since the 80s, for 38 years now, tell our listeners a little bit about the history and how the chorus has changed over the years.
Well, as you said, SGMC was founded in 1984 to support gay men through the AIDS epidemic. And as we slowly came out of those really dark times, it morphed into a chorus that really is helpful to the community artistically, musically. We do a lot of outreach programs and concerts. We love to sing the national anthem. We were lucky enough to sing the national anthem for the Sacramento Kings a couple of months ago, and that was electric. So it's become really outreach to the community, and also bringing in those folks who need a place to belong, who are trying to find that somewhere. And, you know, if you move to a new city as a young gay person or queer person, trans, whatever, you need to find your people, right? You need to be able to find somewhere where you feel safe, where you belong. And frankly, you know, that's not always easy if you have a bar to go to, or, you know, you want to find a more substantive place to belong. So people join the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, I think, a lot of time for that sense of community. And so that's one of the things that we do well, is find those people and keep them safe.
Yeah, and music has a wonderful way of doing that as well. The timing is perfect because y'all had a rehearsal last night and we're going to play some of the songs. So we're going to listen to the chorus perform songs from the rehearsal last night. One of these epic 80s songs is I'm So Excited by the Pointer Sisters. Love that buildup. What great energy. And you're also performing with a band.
Yes, we have a full band, drums, bass, guitar, synthesizer, chock full of cool 80s synth sounds.
That is awesome. Well, we're going to keep moving on to another performance, another 80s hit, obviously. Very familiar anthem, Like a Prayer by Madonna. How could people not dance or sing along when listening to you all?
That's exactly how I feel. I'm hoping that people will sing along with us. They'll get moving in their seats. There will be dancing on stage. We have a small dance ensemble that's going to be there. So it should be quite the party.
That is awesome. Well, our next song is also guaranteed to get people amped up. It's Holding Out for a Hero by Bonnie Tyler.
Do, do, do. hero. I'm holding out for a hero to the end of the night. He's gotta be strong and he's gotta be fast and he's gotta be fresh from the fight. I need a hero. Hero.
What goes into practicing and training for these performances?
Oh my gosh, a lot of hours, a lot of focus. I make rehearsal tracks for everyone so that they can go home and process all the music and try to memorize it. It's basically almost 2 hours worth of music, so a lot of memorization that these folks have to do. I have to give them kudos because they work so hard.
How many singers are part of the chorus?
So we have almost 100 singers this time. We take up a 40-foot riser section, a lot of voices up there.
Wow. What is your background in this? Because going from, you know, like a band, they may have like 3 to 5 people to 100 singers. What attracted you to something like this?
Well, I've been teaching choral music at the high school level for, this will be my 28th year coming up. So this is my wheelhouse. This is the stuff I love to do. And of course, I grew up singing in high school and in college. So it's been a part of my life forever. I first got my taste of a gay chorus when I was in San Francisco. And I joined the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus as their principal accompanist and assistant artistic director. And I just found the joy and the teamwork that was present there, and it just made me want to come back to Sacramento and do it again here.
It was melody at first sight or first listen.
Right.
So we do have one final performance. This is a bonus song by the chorus. It's I'm Still Standing by Elton John. So let's take a quick listen.
You can never know what it's like. Your blood like winter freezes just like ice. And there's a cold and lonely light that shines from you. You wind up like the wreck you hide behind that mask you use. And if you think this world could never win, well look at me, I'm coming back again. I got a taste of love in a simple way. And if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. And I'm still standing after all this time, picking up the pieces of my life without you on my mind.
So Christian, are tickets still for sale this weekend at the Sophia?
Yes, you can go to sacgaymenschorus.org to get your tickets. They're going fast, but if you get to the website and get your tickets, they are still some available.
Well, yeah, just getting a brief preview, I can absolutely understand why. Before I let you go, I just learned that you were the Grand Marshal at the Sacramento Pride Parade last weekend. And how did that feel representing the chorus at Pride?
Oh my goodness, I was so honored to be the Grand Marshal. I just felt really, really honored by it. More importantly, however, the entire Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus was also chosen to be Grand Marshals. And for me, that was the cool thing because, as I said, almost 100 people, they're all volunteers. They Thursday night, we rehearse for 2.5 hours. On Sunday afternoon, they have to take some time off for sectionals. Plus all of the memorization and volunteer work, it's really those 100 singers that deserve to be Grand Marshal. That's what was really honoring, was for all of us to be there together.
Yeah, and that is certainly something to celebrate. Thank you so much, Christian. Have a great time this weekend. I already know you're going to.
Yes, thank you so much, Vicky.
And spreading the good time energy. Christian Bohm is Artistic Director of the Sacramento Gay Men's Chorus, discussing the chorus's 80s rock and pop tribute performance this weekend at the Sophia in Sacramento. We have a link on our website for more details on showtimes and how to buy tickets. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral-Martinez Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.